Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, September 4th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Good to be with you again, Nima. Greetings to you and your viewers and listeners.
Let's start, Alex, with what has happened in China. It was something different, let's put it this way. India joining Russia, China and Iran, North Korea, and many other countries. But I think the game changer in the whole picture was India, the presence of India. They went there, they tried to get closer to the East. How did you find it? What's going on in the mind of these superpowers? Let's put it this way, in the mind of Russia, China, and India, together with Iran.
Well, Lima, it's very interesting, you know, because it always goes back to the question about what is Trump actually doing? Because the United States, or we should say the Western Empire, has been courting India for the last 30 years, more or less. They've been trying to get them on their side. And then, you know, in the last few years, they formed this quad. Remember the quad? United States, Australia, Japan, and India. And this was supposed to be a big counterweight to China. And so it would seem that Trump is quite out of his mind.
Did they consider Pakistan as well, or Pakistan wasn't that much?
I don't think that Pakistan was in the quad. I think it was just India, Japan, Australia, and United States, if I'm not mistaken. And so now Trump pretty much flushed this whole thing down the toilet, and he pushed India into the arms of China. So that would seem counterproductive, unless, you know, you consider that maybe Trump has a different agenda in mind. Because, you know, we tend to treat countries as monoliths. And so, you know, United States is doing this, United States is doing that. And so, but it's not really the United States. It's the people in power. And, you know, I think that pretty much for the last several decades, and I started to become aware of this with, let's say, George Bush Sr., well, even Ronald Reagan, you know, Ronald Reagan had his, you know, the person who was pretty much in charge of foreign policy was William Casey, the head of the CIA, who was a Rhodes Scholar, I think. He was one of these people with very deep liaisons to London. And then you had George Bush Sr., who again was somehow in a strange way on the hook to the city of London. You know, old banking family. And then you had Bill Clinton, another Oxford Rhodes Scholar. And then you had Barack Obama, who was, then another Bush Jr. Then Barack Obama, who his political mentor was Tony Blair, none other than, you know, the knight of the British Empire, and then you had Joe Biden who didn't even know where he was, right? So there was some shadow government in place in Washington, and so that's what we got used to calling the United States. And it's true that there was certain predictability to the U.S. policy under these administrations, and it was very consistent, and it was always pro-war, pro-empire, pro-always treating other countries in a kind of thuggish way, you do as we say, or else. And I think that there's a real change now in the White House with Donald Trump. So Trump does continue with a thuggish style of management. But I think that the substance is changing. And I, you know, I've seen how the media is interpreting this whole thing between Trump and Modi. And then there were some reports about how Trump tried to call Modi and Modi is refusing his phone calls and he's hanging up on him and all this. I, you know, maybe this is true, but maybe it's not true. I don't know. You know, we're in a blizzard of psyops. We have to be careful what we believe or what we don't. But there was no criticism of Trump or the U.S. administration in Beijing by any of the participants. So this wasn't an anti-American gathering. And, you know, then there was like there was a meeting between Robert Fico and Vladimir Putin in Beijing, which was very interesting because it was publicized, but it was publicized very widely because of the Fico's criticism of the policies of the European Union, and then, you know, the exchange he and Vladimir Putin had on that account. But one thing that, you know, kind of went under the radar is that Robert Fico mentioned that the United States, the Westinghouse Corporation, is building a nuclear power plant in Slovakia. And Robert Fico said, you know, it would be very interesting for us if the Russian engineer and Russian companies cooperated on this project with the Westinghouse and with Slovakia on this nuclear power plant. And Vladimir Putin said, like, yes, we would be very interested in that kind of cooperation. And in fact, we have offered similar cooperation to the American side. Maybe he mentioned Westinghouse by name, I'm not sure. We have suggested similar cooperation with the American side on the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, right? And Putin said that we have already been in discussions on this subject with the American side. So I think there's no, you know, I think that order of the day number one is to change the security architecture of the world and to, you know, for the United States to extricate itself from its imperial engagements, where, you know, like it's basically the world's hegemon and the policeman of the world on behalf of the imperial cabal. And then the United States having to emerge as just one of the major powers in the world and embrace the multipolar integrations, which has been explicitly the foreign policy objective of the Trump administration, you know, unless you believe they're lying about that, but I don't see why they would be lying about that. And so if that's the case, then, you know, the United States needs to recover its position as an industrial power in the world. You know, if you're going to trade with the rest of the world, you have to produce something. It can't just be oil and gas and soybeans, you know. You don't want to be a Bantustan, right? You don't want to be like the commodities exporting country. And in order for the United States to re-energize, re-empower its industries, it needs to create a protected market. It needs to introduce tariffs for that reason, which is what Trump has been doing and what has forever been his objective. He's pretty much announced that this is what I want to do. So I think that his imposition of tariffs on China, on India, isn't a punishment to India for trading with Russia. That's just the language that Trump has to use for domestic consumption, for domestic politics, because we have to always remember Trump is the president of the United States, but a lot of the power in the United States resides in Congress. No, power of the purse, most importantly. And in Congress, Trump has very slim majority. And so he has to be very careful how he treads. And a lot of people who are in Congress are still very deeply entrenched with the Cold War mindset, where, you know, Russia is the enemy, India is not, but China is the enemy. We have to confront them. We have to show them how tough we are. And so he has to talk that language So if he wants to introduce tariffs, which is an attack on the British system of free trade, he would get a pushback. But if he wraps it in, we're going to be punishing Russia and we're going to show the Chinese how tough we are, then, you know, all the clapping seals in Congress, they go, yay, you know, look how tough we are. And so I think that this is the reason why Trump appears to be blundering in this situation. But the exchange I just named between Robert Fico and Vladimir Putin confirms something that we've been talking about for months now, Nima, and that is that the discussions and the cooperation between the United States, the Trump administration and the Vladimir Putin's government is far more extensive than we know, that a lot of these discussions and talks are secret. They are not being disclosed, which is probably part of the reason why just 2 or 3 weeks ago, Tulsi Gabbard said no more sharing of intelligence with Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand about our discussions with the Russians. And so if this is the case, you know, that suggests, that confirms that Trump is serious about embracing the multipolar integrations. And if you're embracing the multipolar integrations, that it doesn't make any sense to antagonize Russia, China, and India, because this is the core of the multipolar integrations process. So I think that Trump is just doing his usual in the public relations sphere, predominantly for domestic consumption, and that the real deal is going on behind the scenes, under the radar, that his administration is having extensive talks about with the Russians, with the Chinese, probably with the Indians as well. You know, somebody will have explained this to them and to say, like, look, you know, nothing personal. We have to change our policies. This is how it's going to be. Pay no attention to, you know, our press releases, to our press conferences, to all the, you know, trash talk. We are, you know, we're on board. We're with you. And, you know, Trump got the opportunity to say something antagonistic towards the Chinese and towards the whole parade in China 2 days ago on Tuesday in the Oval Office press conference, where, you know, some journalists said, like, oh, you know, aren't you worried about this big show of force that the Chinese, you know, made? And he says, like, no, absolutely not. I have a great relationship with Xi Jinping, and the Chinese need us. And then, of course, he, you know, Trump can't help being Trump, so he had to say that the Chinese need us more than we need them, and that the whole reason why they threw this military parade is because they were hoping that I would watch. You know, that's Trump being Trump, unfortunately. But I think that the actual real substance of what is going on behind the scenes are, I would say, good news and positive developments.
Yeah. Alex, I think one of the main messages, one of the main points on the part of China, and Xi told us on Victory Day, he said that the Chinese nation is a great nation that is never intimidated by any bullies and always values independence and forges ahead. Today humanity again has to choose between peace and war, dialogue and confrontation, win-win cooperation and zero-sum game. And we had Donald Trump commenting on what has happened in China and his comment on China's military parade. Here is what he said, Alex. I'll just bring it up. I think, Alex, after all, what's going on in China, what has happened in China is of concern for the military-industrial complex in the United States. Here is what Donald Trump said.
I thought it was a beautiful ceremony. I thought it was very, very impressive. But I understood the reason they were doing it, and they were hoping I was watching, and I was watching. My relationship with all of them is very good. We're going to find out how good it is over the next week or two. I think that we helped China very much, as you know, when they talk about freedom. And I don't believe that, and maybe I'm wrong, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't believe that America, that the United States was acknowledged for helping China to get to gain its freedom. But perhaps that was just a that was a sleight of hand. I mean, I was very surprised. I watched the speech last night. President Xi's a friend of mine, but I thought that the United States should have been mentioned last night during that speech because we helped China very, very much.
And the main point, in my opinion, is not China is preparing, is getting prepared to attack anybody. They're trying to tell everybody on this planet that they're prepared to defend themselves and what they have, what they're trying to expand, which it's all about technology and economic ties. You're taking what are these different sources of pressure coming to the president of the United States? Because you can imagine how much he's under the pressure from the establishment.
Well, Nima, you know, until Trump took over at the White House, the preparations for war against China were full on. You know, this was not even like, if we can't avoid a war against China, then, you know, we have to be prepared. No, they were preparing for war against China. That was the whole purpose of the Quad. We had on record statements by American military personnel in Taiwan who were telling that they are, we're preparing the theater for war exactly as we did in Ukraine. So I think that the attitude and the mindset of hostility towards China is still prevalent in the American political class. I think that this war was being planned not because anybody even had any delusions that they could win. But you know, empires don't fight wars because they think they will win. They fight wars to keep them going because it maintains a certain cohesion of the society at home. You know, there's big bad external enemy that needs to be fought. And then you can explain all the problems of society, you know, the decaying infrastructure, the decaying healthcare, standards of living, economic crisis, inflation. All of this you can then blame on China. So that's why you need that war. And so I think that there are very powerful vested interests in the United States that still desperately want that war. And so now for Trump to steer the course away from war and towards a completely new kind of foreign policy is delicate and it's complicated. And I think that he has to steer that course very, very carefully. And again, you know, people have to keep in mind that the most important fight that Trump is fighting is actually on the domestic front. Because right now, you know, he has the majority in the Senate, majority in the House, and the White House. Fine. But that majority is very slim. And it could slip away very easily. And so not only that, but, you know, among the Republicans, so we're talking about a Republican majority, but not all the Republicans are loyal to Trump. And many of them are actually disloyal to Trump. You know, they'll stab him in the back if they get a chance to. And so this is, you know, I think that people have exaggerated expectations. They think that, you know, Trump becomes president, he gets elected, he walks into the White House and then he snaps his fingers and everything gets rearranged the way he wants it to. It doesn't work that way. And, you know, people have, we've all seen how, you know, U.S., you know, most of U.S. Congress is owned by AIPAC, you know, Congressman Massey has explained how practically everybody but except him and maybe another person have an AIPAC minder. They call them multiple times a day to make sure how they vote how they're informed, what their priorities are. We've seen that a lot of congressmen in front of their offices, they have Israeli flags and it says, I support Israel, I stand with Israel, things like this. So, you know, these are the realities that predate Trump's administration. You know, this is a system that has been set up and reinforced and entrenched for decades now. It's not a simple matter to change it just like that. And so, you know, I see a lot of Trump's stunts as maybe ways of navigating this complicated minefield. And I don't know why Trump has to adopt this thuggish, vulgar way of communicating, but you know, he's been in the media, he's been in the show business. Maybe that works in the American culture. You know, maybe being a Taoist sage and speaking in complex abstract concepts doesn't work as well. I don't know. It's annoying. It's irritating. It's painful and embarrassing to watch. But so far, I have to say that if you compare where we are today and where we were 7 months ago, I think that the world is in a much, much better shape. I think that the risk of World War III is much, much lower. And I also think that the risk of the United States starting the war against China is also much, much lower. And I think maybe part of that is ejecting India from the Quad into the arms of China, you know, basically dissipating that hostility, that whole setup rigged for the future war. Now, I don't know if that was a deliberate policy on Trump's part, but that's the effect of it. And I think that's good news for everybody else.
You remember the head of American military in Japan during the Biden administration said that they're preparing to fight China by 2025. And he literally was talking about the next administration coming. And they may thought that Kamala Harris would win and they had all these plans prepared to do, but it seems that Donald, what's so amazing about him, and I really appreciate that he's honest, the way that it was good, that was a, you know, he doesn't try to diminish what he's witnessing. You know, this is a good point on the part of the president of the United to appreciate what he's facing. And for the case of Iran, he did the same thing. I remember he said that, you know, he's not trying to diminish Russia, China, I would say India, but it seems that India is somehow feeling that the United States is prepared to sacrifice India for the sake of what's going on, or the establishment in the United States. I'm not talking about just Donald Trump himself, because it's a whole, there is a lot going on in Washington. Many people, the Trump administration, it literally divided in two or three or, I don't know, four factions, and they're communicating to each other. But the outcome for India somehow it's somehow confusing. Who are we to the United States? Are they going to stay with us if we support them? These are real issues in the mind of the Indian government.
I honestly wouldn't know, Nima, how these things are being perceived by the Indian government. And obviously, most of the people will perceive it the way mainstream media presents it. The logic of power says that there's always going to be some kind of an inner sanctum of sages crafting foreign policy. And so that's going to be Narendra Modi, probably Jai Shankar, the foreign minister, and maybe another handful of people. And I think that they will know the truth, but they will not divulge that truth. You know, they will just sail along with the realities that impose themselves, they will inevitably have to allow the, you know, the narratives to form as they need to be formed. And I really think that the United States, the Trump administration, is facing the most complicated equation of all. That they you know, Trump's maneuvering space is much more fraught with risk than even India's, Russia's, China's, Iran's. They have, you know, they have clear leadership, they have clear direction. So they are opposed to the Western empire, to the, you know, rules-based global order. And they have legitimacy in that sense. They have the support of their populations, and they probably have support of most of the world's population in that sense. But Trump has a house deeply divided. And, you know, this comes after decades and decades of the United States being harnessed as the, you know, military enforcement arm of the Western empire. The most powerful people in the United States are people who have been in service of this. You know, the whole business setup, you know, the military industrial complex, the big ag, the big pharma, all of this has been kind of growing by accretion around this foreign policy. You know, this was clear. This has been clear for decades, you know, because this was already Che Guevara used to said famously, you know, he said, I envy you Americans because you are fighting the most important fight of all, because you live in the belly of the beast. And that's really true. And I think that, you know, this is now Trump's assignment. I, you know, the more I look, it's been 7 months now. The more I look, the more I tend to believe Trump. And I don't absolve him from his blunders and errors, because, you know, he has done a number of them, and big ones. But I think that he, you know, when they say we want to end the empire, we want to be embracing the multipolar integrations, I want to end the wars, I think he is sincere about that. It's just that, you know, he's not the emperor in the United States. He has a Congress there. He has like hundreds upon hundreds of lobbyists in Washington. There's very, very powerful corporate interests that have a lot at stake. We're seeing, in addition to this, you know, geopolitical stuff, you see what's going on with the, you know, the administration taking on the big pharma. That's a big fight. And then Trump, you know, if you go back to the beginning of his administration, he said that he wants to reduce the American military budget by half. Well, that's going to make a lot of people in the military industrial complex unhappy. And then he wants to eliminate nuclear weapons. They want to end vaccine mandates. He wants to end subsidies to the big agriculture. They want to make America healthy again, which is going to put a big wrench into the interests of the big food and the big ag. So it's a very, very ambitious agenda. But it seems to me, after 7 months of observing not only the rhetoric, not the public declarations and press releases, but the actual policies, I think that the administration is sincere, and that they really are trying to change the course of the United States.
I think, after all, we have to be honest with ourselves about China, Russia, and India, even Iran, because these countries are somehow so much connected to each other. You look at India, it's China, it's its neighbor, and they have a very important economic tie with Russia. You know that they're importing Russian oil more than before, and from 10% and 41%. It's huge what's going on in India.
It's massive.
You cannot ignore that, Alex. You cannot detach India from what's going on in the region. And I don't know how, what do they want from India, in your opinion? What does the United States want from India? What would be the best shape for India, being a somehow related, connected to the East, closer to the East, but at the end of the day, working with the United States? How do you see about, how do you feel about the way that Washington wants India?
I don't know, to be honest, Nima. I think that, you know, India has to adapt to the changes. And I think that India has been kind of brought into this position exactly because, you know, the previous administrations had an agenda for India. You know, they wanted it as an ally. They, you know, India has 1.4, 1.6 billion people. That's a lot of military age men there. So, you know, if you want to go destroy China, you're going to need, you know, you're not going to be doing it with troops from Singapore or Japan or Australia. You need very large armies. And, you know, India has been playing into this in part as well. So now is the time of adjustment. But I, you know, Trump has made friendly overtures to Russia. Trump has made friendly overtures to China, to North Korea. I think there's no reason why Trump isn't going to be making friendly overtures to India. And I think that they will be able to bridge their differences. But whether Trump administration has particular expectations of India, or, you know, to impose some kind of a regional role on India, I can't say. I genuinely don't know.
We had Armenia and Azerbaijan being invited to China, and Iran talked with Turkey about what's going on in the region. And I am sure that China, I don't know, because China is not just about Russia and Iran and the security of the region, is about China as well and the Belt and Road Initiative. You know, the picture is much more complex than what the way that somehow we're talking about the security, the way Iran sees the northern border of Iran and how Israel used them to attack Iran. But it's a minor issue when it comes to the big picture of what's going on there. How do you see these two countries, the way that China, I would say, tried to bring them into the calculation, or they may have some sort of talks during the meeting they had in China?
Sorry, just to make sure I understand, are you talking about Iran versus Azerbaijan?
I'm talking about Armenia, Azerbaijan.
Armenia, Azerbaijan.
Yeah,
that's interesting, Nima. Well, I think that Azerbaijan is going to have to climb off their horse and adapt to the changes that are happening on the Eurasian continent. And I, first of all, I think that they are putting themselves in the position of Ukraine in a way, you know, risk. They're putting themselves at risk of being destroyed. And then I also believe that Azerbaijan is not in a particularly strong position to antagonize either Iran or Russia, because if that were the case, if this was a strong card to play, then the Western powers would have played that card already long before, you know. But they went first with Ukraine. That was their strongest card. Then that was starting to fail, and then they opened the next front in the Middle East. That didn't escalate the way they hoped. And so now this seems to be, you know, throwing the kitchen sink. And you already see that Azerbaijan is kind of pulling back. And so and then Armenia, that's really bizarre because the president of Armenia is also completely in the pocket of the globalists. But then again, you know, this is yet another another leader who has no legitimacy. So I don't know how long he can hang on and continue with these basically self-destructive policies for Armenia. You know, it's almost like it's almost exactly like Moldova under Sandu. Yeah. I think that they have already lost legitimacy and that it's only a question of time when either they have to adapt to the changes or they're going to be swept out of power.
Was that surprising to you that they didn't talk about Ukraine?
No, not at all. No, Ukraine is finished. Ukraine is a done deal, and I think that the whole world who doesn't, you know, consume Western mainstream media narrative understand what's going on there and supports Russia. And that's normal. It's common sense. And it's obvious. It's just that in the West, you know, we are in a blizzard of propaganda. So we think that Ukraine has something to do with freedom and democracy and human rights and, you know, all this nice sounding stuff that is actually completely untrue.
After all, we see Europeans, it seems that they feel, in my opinion, that they can continue with the case of Ukraine. And as we talk, there is a meeting, they had some sort of meeting and talks between French, Germany, and Ukraine. What do they want at this particular moment? I don't know if you saw the map on the wall behind the
Gerasimov, yeah?
Gerasimov. He shows that all of Ukraine, all the eastern part of Ukraine, and going to not just four oblasts that are already part of Russia, but Odessa, Nikolaev, going up to Kharkov, they're all part of Russia on the map.
You know, Nima, I have to say, I did see that. And I have to say that I suspect that that's also a psyop. Because I think that for Russia, the pivotal question for Russia is whether the government in Kiev realigns back with Moscow, becomes a friendly, neutral state again, or whether they remain loyal vassal of the West. That changes everything. If the government in Kiev realigns back with Moscow, then it becomes, you know, with over time it will become like Belarus today, you know, almost like an autonomous part of Russia, of the, you know, completely within the Russian sphere of influence. And then, of course, you know, obviously the Russians would have a great deal of control over Ukraine's government, and they would be able to neutralize threat to their security without having to conquer Ukraine militarily. And at that point, which is maybe some years into the future, I see no difference essentially whether you get to that objective through military conquest or through just making sure that, you know, there's a change in government in Kiev and that the new government is loyal to you. And, you know, military conquest is always a lot more expensive. So I think that if you can avoid it, you would want to avoid it. And to put the map like that for everyone to see, I thought that was a psyop for some reason. And obviously, it made everybody's head explode in the West. Maybe it was just a prank. Who knows?
Maybe they want to have that part of Ukraine being somehow totally governed by Russia. I'm not talking about capturing the buffer zone that we were talking about, Odessa, Nikolaev, going up to Kharkov, and considering that as a buffer zone, but having some sort of autonomy, some sort of self-governance. And that may be the future in the mind of Russians.
Well, yes, I think so. But you see, if you go by the means of military conquest, so you're going to have to do a lot more fighting, then your troops are going to go in to, let's say, Zaporozhye, into Kharkov, into Odessa, and all these places. And then you're still going to have to rely on the local structures of government to implement certain policies that you want so that Ukraine is no longer a threat to you, so that it's a nation that cooperates, that's neutral, that doesn't go into NATO, that doesn't host foreign troops, that doesn't acquire nuclear missiles, that doesn't install American missile launch facilities and so forth. You have to do that through the local government still. The only thing that changes is if you go by, let's say, just changing the government in Kiev, same thing happens, but without your troops having to go into Odessa and Kharkov and all of this. So you're going after the same objective. You're going to have to use the same means. The only difference with military conquest is that your troops are going to go in first and they're going to exert pressure on local governments. If the troops don't go in first, you're going to exert pressure on local governments through the central government. But you're going to end up at the same place. Obviously, military conquest could be quicker, but it's more expensive. It costs lives. It costs destruction of the country. You're going to be in one way or another responsible for the reconstruction. So I don't know, but it seems to me that the Russians are not particularly keen on military conquest and waging war. I think they are after taking control of Ukraine.
Here is, Alex, here is what NATO Secretary General said about China.
China are investing heavily to build up and modernize their militaries. Their defense industries are producing weapons and heavy military equipment at a remarkable, I might say, at a staggering rate. And this is not just to show off at major military parades in Moscow or like yesterday in Beijing, but to aggressively exert influence, attempt to reshape the global order and undermine our freedom and security. This is at stake.
So,
well, thank you for that, Nima.
You know, he's just putting out the facts, but at the end, he just somehow tried to see what they're doing is aggressive because they're diminishing our dominance. This is the problem, I think, that Russia and China and Iran is facing right now with the West. They don't want them to be in their somehow dominating the region. Russia doesn't want the United States to be in Ukraine, doesn't want Europeans to be in Ukraine, NATO weapons. And even in the Middle East, they don't want, the United States can improve the economic ties with the countries in the region. But after all, when it comes to security, it's much more sensitive for them.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, NATO has a different role. You know, their whole reason for existing is to be the guarantor of security in a world where you have two opposed blocks, and then, you know, they are the basically the protection racket. And so two-block world or three-block world, if it goes away, if it dissipates, then they completely lose their relevance. And so, of course, they want to maintain this polarization, these divided blocks that are hostile to each other, because that makes Mark Rutte important, you know, that makes General Ben Hodges and Richard Dearlove and all these minions of the of Western power, it makes them very relevant and important and tough. But this is going away. This is all really going away. And it's not only because, you know, you have Russia and China and Iran and the BRICS and the SCO and Global South realigning away from the Western Empire. It's also and it's not only because also because the United States is changing their policy course. It's also because the I think that the whole concept of NATO and their military doctrine are becoming very obsolete. So even if you take them at their best, if you took them for viable militaries with powerful, effective weapons, they've become obsolete. You know, they've become like like the last century's fighting force that can no longer defeat anybody, pretty much. You know, let's remember that it was 5 years ago that the United, no, 4 years ago, August 27, August 2021, that the United States had to withdraw from Afghanistan with their tail tucked between their legs after 20 years of trying to subdue the Taliban. With all their weaponry, with all their drones, with all their technology, with all the money that they spent there, they still were defeated. And then they were defeated by the Yemenis in the Red Sea. So, you know, and now here we're talking about NATO with the United States not quite so committed to the alliance. I think they're just grasping for straws, trying to remain relevant. And then, you know, I could say the same about Friedrich Merz and mini Napoleon Macron. You know, they're meeting with Zelensky, they're going to be issuing statements and platitudes, and they're going to be talking about integrity and sovereignty and democracy and freedom and all these things. But they're just trying to keep themselves on the map. They're trying to remain relevant. Macron now has, according to the latest figures, allegedly, his support in the public is 15%. I don't even know if that number is true, because, you know, I live in Monaco in the south of France. I don't know anybody who supports Macron. So I don't know who they polled. Maybe they polled Macron's inner family circles. But, you know, even at that, they are extremely unpopular leaders. They have no legitimacy among the people, and neither does Merz. Everybody hates him. And same thing with Starmer. So all of these powers that are opposed to Russia, opposed to China, opposed to BRICS, opposed to multipolar integrations, and that, by the way, also hate Trump. You know, because if you hear what they're saying, they're kissing up to Trump, but they don't like Trump. They're all extremely, extremely weak, and they're illegitimate, and they are really living under the shadow of a revolution. And I think that that's why we see increasingly more aggressive censorship in Germany, in Britain, in France, and elsewhere in the West. You see these things of introducing digital IDs and CBDCs, because they know that their system is disintegrating. And I think that they understand that the only way that they could save themselves, if they could again get everybody riled up about an external enemy, send all the men off to war, you know, the fighting age males, everybody off to war. And then you could say, like, well, you know, yeah, the economy is crap, but it's not our fault. It's the Russians. And, you know, your savings are gone because of hyperinflation. Well, the Russians are to blame. And you can't get appointment with a doctor. Well, you know, we have to support the boys at the front. And there's no food in the stores, and there's no medicines in the pharmacies. well, you know, it's the shared sacrifice. We have to all support the war effort, so that they would save themselves. But the war is kind of not happening, and so they're in a panic. And I think that everything else they have is simply the narrative management. And so that's I think what they're doing now.
Alex, what is the outcome? You've mentioned the war in Afghanistan and the fight between Yemenis and the United States under the Trump administration, and the case of Ukraine coming into the calculation. What does that mean? How can these fights being translated in the U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Venezuela and the case of the Middle East? Because we know that I literally believe that Netanyahu, after all, would attack Iran again because of his survival, because of what's going on in Israel. It doesn't matter. In Israel, they're talking about Gaza turning into Afghanistan for Israelis. And Netanyahu is in a dire situation in Israel politically. How do you see these factors coming into the calculation on the part of the... If you want to talk about a little bit about Israel, feel free to talk about it. But in the whole situation, how does Trump translate all of these information coming to the administration in terms of Venezuela and the Middle East?
Okay, so just to first touch on Israel, I think that Israel is a lost cause. It's a slow motion train wreck that's going to turn out to be fatal. I don't even understand how people in the Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet function. I think they're all delusional and psychotic, because they're talking about greater Israel. They're at war with everybody, and they're on their way of being to war. They're on their way to taking on Turkey. You know, they've already multiple times said that Turkey is their main threat now, even greater threat than Iran. So they're preparing for that war, and they are saying that they will, oh yeah, totally, we have to go again and go to war against Iran, which can literally wipe them off the face of the earth. So I genuinely am confused. But the problem is, you know, for Trump, the problem is trying how to avoid that war, because, you know, if there's another showdown between Israel and Iran, it's very hard to see how Trump will be able to avoid coming to Israel's rescue. That will be complicated. We'll see what happens. When it comes to Venezuela, I think this is a stunt again. I don't, you know, Trump is talking about, Trump sent a small flotilla of ships and 4,000 Marines, if I'm not mistaken, 4,000. I expect that about half of those are, you know, troops that stay on the ships, the crew of these ships. Yeah. And so that means that there's only 2,000, maybe half of that, who could actually land in Venezuela and go to Caracas and change the regime. That is beyond ridiculous. You know, that's a joke. You know, Caracas is at 1,000 meters altitude, and there's a big mountain separating Caracas from the coast. So, and there's one road going between the coastline and Caracas. So how you could even dream about regime changing Venezuela with 2,000 Marines? It can't, you know, this is another one of those things where Trump's policy measure is so dumb, so moronic, that it can't possibly be what it looks like. So I take it as a stunt, and we'll find out, you know, maybe they build up bigger forces and maybe they send reinforcement. And, you know, maybe if they bring 200,000 Marines to the Caribbean and get them ready to launch an invasion of Venezuela, that looks more like the like the force that you would need, but maybe it's maybe even that's not enough. You know, it Venezuela is not a flat terrain, like from Ukraine to Russia. It's not like a flat terrain where you can just march across. It's like a big mountain that goes very high up. It's very steep. It's practically tropical vegetation, and then descends down into Caracas. I don't know. Maybe they just want to take oil production facilities in the Lake of Maracaibo. I don't know. But at any rate, it's at this time, the whole thing seems like a stunt, because otherwise it's just too stupid to even waste time worrying about it.
Yeah, it's not. We know that Russia, China, and Iran are so much in contact with Venezuela. How do you see the reaction? How do you see if something that big happens, that something a massive attack on part of the United States happens? How do you see the reaction on the part of these countries? Are they going to just sit aside and watch what's going on, or they're going to do something?
Well, I know that China and Russia both already have fairly extensive military cooperation with Venezuela. I don't know what kinds of weaponry they exchanged. I think that, you know, they probably provided certain types of weaponry to the Venezuelans. I don't know this, but I would expect that one of the main things that they would have to provide them would be anti-aircraft systems. Because, you know, if there was an invasion, first thing you would have to do is impose a no-fly zone and control the skies. And so then, you know, if Venezuela had Russian or Chinese anti-aircraft systems, then that would make it very difficult, dangerous, risky for the Americans to try to impose a no-fly zone over Venezuela. And so I expect that this is already done to some extent, which again would suggest that the whole thing of sending a very small fleet of American forces to the Venezuelan coastlines is just a stunt, maybe a distraction even domestically. But, you know, we have to find out, because for sure nothing happens with 2,000 troops or 4,000 troops. And so we'll see I think didn't they already make a about face and start to sail away from Venezuela? I think I read something to that effect
recently. I haven't seen that. I see escalations, because what's so strange, Alex, to me, because the United States is at this particular moment, they're dealing with huge issues, because in the last, the dollar has lost 50% of its value versus gold in the last 3 years. You know, this is huge for the United States. What's going on with dollar and the way that they're pushing these countries? We were talking India, China, Russia, Iran together, which Donald Trump was not willing, in my opinion, to do that before coming to power, before being elected, because he talked about it. He said, why do we need Iran and Russia to be our enemies? We are destroying the power of dollar. This is totally the opposite way. And they're going to Venezuela. It's going to be it's going to be as huge as Vietnam, but it's going to be huge for the U.S. economy if you go in that way, because Venezuelans are not going to surrender and say, so come over and you can have everything. They're going to fight.
I agree. And that's exactly why I have a hard time believing that it's even that, you know, like that. This has got to be some kind of a stunt, because otherwise it's just too stupid. It's just like really so profoundly moronic that, you know, you would even have to believe that Trump is a complete moron, or people in his government who advise him, or that it's a distraction, that it really is a stunt. And I have a very hard time believing that people in Trump administrations are moron, because I think that he's surrounded with some fairly smart people. And of course, I know that, you know, the pressure from the banking cartel and from the big oil would be, okay, go get Venezuela for us. You know, we want to take Venezuela. But this already happened in his first term, I think in 2017 or so.
Yeah.
And Trump came out and talked tough about Venezuela. Ah, yeah, we're going to change the regime and Maduro has got to go. And, you know, Juan Guaido is the best guy and he's the real president. But nothing happened. Trump tasked Elliot Abrams and John Bolton with the regime change operations in Venezuela. Elliot Abrams is you know, he used to be very prominent in the Iran-Contras affair back in the 80s, right? And then he disappeared. I didn't even know he existed any longer. And John Bolton, you know, Trump himself thinks he's the dumbest person he's ever known, right? So, you know, if Trump took on that project, like let's change the regime in Venezuela, and then he tasked two complete morons, two of the biggest flunkies in Washington, D.C. with this, then it tells me that Trump is not sincere about that. And then obviously nothing happened because Maduro is still in power. The regime change didn't happen. And so it could be that this, again, is some kind of a stunt, maybe to deflect public attention, maybe to appease these, you know, interests, the big oil and the big banks who want a regime change in Venezuela. But I don't know if he really wants to do that. And you're not 100%, you're not going to do it with 2,000 troops.
What we've learned from the Iranian side, Alex, that they had a very important meeting between Iran and China in terms of the defense systems of Iran. And my understanding of the behavior of China, they see Russia, Iran, and to some extent India as their front line. And because they see that these are fighting on behalf of us, because if they're not fighting, they're going to come to us. Yes. And so we have to continue support these countries in order just to convince the West not come to us, because that would hugely influence the economy of China and the future of China. How do you see that mindset? How do you see the way the cooperation between the three countries, I would say Iran, China, and Russia, and the way that to what extent you see China supporting these? The case of Ukraine, I think, is just getting away because there is nothing there in Ukraine to be saved on the part of the West. But still, they may consider the case of Iran. Iran goes away from the picture. Russia would be hugely in trouble from the southern part. China's security in terms of energy would be hugely influenced by any change in Iran. How do they want Iran to be? How do they, to what extent they're prepared to support Iran, Russia and China, in your opinion?
I expect that they will go 100% all the way. Because these three powers very much depend on one another. You know, as you noted, you know, Russia is very, very vulnerable to jihadis, which are now a relatively large force, and they are controlled by the British. And the British have already cultivated the jihadi forces for the last 15, 20 years. And they actually, you know, Britain doesn't hardly have a military, but they are using the jihadis as their proxy forces. And so, you know, Russia surrounded with, Dagestan, Chechnya, Kazakhstan. These are all, the South Caucasus, Azerbaijan. All these areas are porous. And from there, Russia is very vulnerable to a reemergence of Islamic terrorism aimed at destabilizing Russia. then China, you know, if for some reason the West prevailed in Ukraine, they won, and they managed to overturn the regime in Russia and topple Vladimir Putin and put in place some Russian Zelensky in the Kremlin. They would do, you know, a president who would be controlled by Western powers. They would do exactly with Russia as they did with Ukraine. That is, they would weaponize Russia against China. So the Russian military, their weaponry, would now become a threat to China, and a huge threat. And so obviously, you know, for Chinese, is it existential to support Russia and to support the Vladimir Putin's regime. And then, you know, for Russia, China is equally important as a trade and export market, as a country with which they can exchange technologies, have access to the Eastern Pacific, to the Western Pacific. So all three nations, but I think particularly at this point, Iran and Russia are very, very important to China. And I think they're going to support them without any reserve. You know, for anybody in the West who, I think there are some people like that in politics who think that if they offer some, you know, trade deals to the Chinese, we're going to reduce the tariffs, or we're going to, like, that they will be able to overturn this partnership. It's a delusion. And the same thing from the Russians. You know, they, you know, some people think that, oh, we can, you know, we can seduce Russia away from China. We can, you know, maybe promise them lifting of sanctions or something like that. No, that's never going to happen, because they understand, you know, the West doesn't make friends. The West only uses one power against the other. And so if they're being friendly to you today, it's because they want you to fight on their behalf tomorrow. And everybody has understood this. So nobody believes them anymore. And nobody's interested in doing to their country what the Ukrainians have done to Ukraine.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Nima. Thank you for the invite. Greetings to everyone out there. And until the next time.
See you soon. Bye-bye. See you.